Yeah, we're okay. Okay, thank you. So it's a pleasure to be here. The more I come to Northern England and Scotland, the more I like it. Can I just for my information and to see what I'm up against, how many of you are theorists? Okay. And how many of you know about B oscillations? Have ever done B oscillations? Okay, so this is a plot that's not in your handouts. This is a plot that I added after our discussion this morning. This is the famous amplitude plot in B oscillations. I just wanted to, because I figured most of you didn't understand what Glenn and I were talking about. So here's what happens. Here's how you do B oscillations. So you have a probability density function, and instead of just putting in whether there is an oscillating term or not, you say, well, I multiply that with something which I call the amplitude A. And then you're going to scan over various values of delta MS, and you're going to see what the amplitude is. You build this into a big likelihood function. You do all your experimental stuff. It's a difficult analysis, and so on and so forth. And then you scan over the oscillation frequency, which is that delta MS, and you see what value your likelihood function likes A, basically. This is what you do. And if you do your experiment right, this has a number of advantages, because if you're seeing oscillations at the right frequency, that A has to go to 1. If it goes to 2, you know that you're doing something wrong. Okay? If it goes to 3 or 4, then really bad things are going on. And you see that you have a region where you're very sensitive. Basically, the distance between whatever your point is and this size tells you how sensitive you are in a certain sense. So here you're very sensitive, but there's nothing to see because B sub S oscillates at a much larger frequency than that. And then you see that at some value, this is the CDF plot, because CDF has a vastly superior detector when it comes to this. So at some point, your amplitude goes to 1, and then it comes back down. And it means that this is the oscillation frequency. So this is what we were talking about this morning. You can do the same thing with the standard model Higgs, and you parameterize its existence between 0 and 1, and then you can scan over the Higgs mass, and in principle, you should get a bump. And the width of that bump is related to basically your measurement resolution in delta MS here, and it would be in MH in the other case. And you see here at high values, we have no sensitivity. So this is an example, by the way, of a successful search. This is not a new physics search, though. This was anticipated, except that, as Gino said, we didn't really know where this was, and it wasn't obvious that you could see this at the Tevatron. And then it turned out that it's a lower end of the standard model values that was the true value, and so this led to success. Okay, anyway, so that's to follow up on the question from this morning. And so now let me start on searches from new physics. And I would like to point out that I'm going to try to do this from an experimental point of view. So we are unavoidably biased by all the education we get from theorists and that tell us this is a standard model, there's this Higgs thing, there's supersymmetry, there's that, and things like that. Sometimes it's good to try to remember what we actually think we know and what is not so obvious, and what are certain assumptions we make. And we're driven by the way we present things, and the way we look at plots, and the way we look at diagrams that we use in various ways to believe that certain things which we just assume are actually things that we know, and or at least think we know. And that's not always so obvious. So I'll talk about this from an experimental point of view. Now, depending on whether you're a theorist or an experimenter, you're going to try to take something different away from these 2 hours. I think my message to the theorists is I'm going to try to explain what we as experimenters do. And that'll help you figure out that when you see an experimental result, what type of trust can you have, and what is it that experimenters do, and what are all the hoops they jump through to get to these results. And then for experimenters, I think I want to illustrate a number of the things. I have quite a few Tevatron examples because there we don't actually know the right answer, so it's a little bit harder. And hopefully you'll take away, well, this is the kind of stuff I'm going to have to do a successful analysis. Okay? So this is the state of high energy physics in 2009. basically. These are diagrams that you know very well. I don't need to go into this part. I on purpose just put the values here of the CKM matrix elements, because we like to represent the CKM matrix as something nearly diagonal. But it's not at all, and the reason, and that drives also our representation of the quarks in this arrangement. But there's really nothing that tells us that this is a right or a wrong arrangement, and there's nothing that says that the CKM matrix has to be diagonal. You can rearrange it in a different way, we just don't know. And this is one representation, it's just as good as any other at this point. Okay? Once we get some information from higher up about grand unification or something like that, maybe we decide that this is not actually the right way to represent it, and we need to rearrange which quarks go with which and things like that in doubles. Okay. Similarly, I think now, even if you go to the PDG, you don't have, so I replaced these already, and the PDG, the big table that people hang on the wall, you know, the equivalent of that thing, but then for particle physics, you don't have nu e, nu mu, nu tau anymore, it's nu 1, nu 2, nu 3. I could say 1, 2, 3 here, and so on. It's good to remember that at some point. So, to try to remove some of the bias, I like to start with putting the standard model in words, and so I'll read out the way I see it. So, matter is built of spin 1/2 particles that interact by exchanging three different kinds of spin 1 particles, and these three different kinds of spin 1 particles correspond to three different gauge interactions. Now, this is quite a strong statement. This has a lot of content behind it. There appear to be three generations of matter particles. Having four is not completely excluded, but it's certainly disfavored. If there is a fourth generation, it certainly doesn't look like one of the first three. The four different matter particles in each generation, and I don't know what the exact arrangement is, carry different combinations of quantized charges, and these characterize their couplings to the interaction bosons. This is what makes an up quark different from a down quark, for example. And the matter fermions and the weak bosons have mass. And then gravitation is presumably mediated by spin 2 gravitons. These are very hard to detect, so we haven't done that yet. Gravitation is extremely weak for typical particle masses, and so we have no handle on that, really, experimentally. And there appear to be three macroscopic dimensions. Okay, these are things we can all agree on, and this is quite an achievement in and of itself. It's good to remind ourselves also that the standard model is really a theory of interactions. Okay, so the properties of the fermions, the constituents of matter, are just inputs which come from experimental data. There is nothing in the standard model which predicts the properties of the fermions. However, the properties of the interaction bosons in terms of couplings, propagations, and masses are linked. So you do an experiment, you measure a few things, and based on the standard model relationships, you can predict others, and then you get consistency or not, and this is where the standard model is extremely successful. So predictions are verified at incredible levels of precision, and we have had the standard model for about 30 years. There are really no serious cracks. These are examples that you've seen before, and I'm not going to go into them. But this number of measurements with this level of success is really quite impressive. Okay, so having said that, so now we're left with a gazillion questions. And you can make a long list of these. Here are a few of them, which I think are important. There's a question of what exactly is spin, and we can go into that. In more, you guys all know this thing that Feynman did to explain spin 1/2. Okay, maybe I'll do it at dinner. What actually is color? What is electric charge? I mean, is it something static? So I take electric charge and I glue it on the particle? Or is it something dynamic? Is it really the reflection of something dynamic? We think magnetism now, we know, is something dynamic, right? It comes from the movement of charges. It's not something static that you stick onto a dipole. But is that true for electric charge? It may be. Why are these things quantified? That suggests that for all of these things, there are boundary conditions. Okay. Are there only three generations? If so, why? Why is there no such thing like a neutral color fermion? Oops. That's not so good. So why is there no neutral colored fermion. There was a paper not so long ago, about 6 months ago, I think, that tried to come with some type of explanation for that. Tried some speculation about how you could set up a group and see what happened if you had seen things like that. So what's mass is a question which we keep on asking. Maybe the right question is, why are particles so light? Is there a link between particle and nucleon masses? We have to remember that this whole visible mass of the universe has nothing to do with the Higgs boson. Right? It comes from the chiral symmetry breaking QCD. So is there a link between that mass and the mass of particles that we believe come from the Higgs boson or a similar mechanism? How does all of this reconcile with gravitation? Is there actually a link between the Higgs and gravitation? Something we don't really know. The issue of how many space-time dimensions is a very interesting question. Okay, so this is something I think people have talked about before me. There is a known problem with, if I consider the standard model as in that first slide or second slide with high energy physics in 2009, which doesn't have a Higgs, okay, so only the known stuff, then there's a problem. Because if you collide W's and Z's at high energy, which is not easy to do, this is what the SSC was designed to do, and that's why it went to 40 TeV. It's possible at LEP, but it's hard. At the LHC, but it's hard. So if you collide W's and Z's, then the scattering cross-section grows with center of mass energy, and then at some point you go over what we call the limit, and bad things happen. And that happens at about 1.7 TeV. You remember probably from some relativistic quantum mechanics classes, you must have calculated some simple Feynman diagrams, and maybe this was part of it at some point. And in the early days of neutrino scattering, things happened at low energy, and so people didn't know about this W, and this was then a four Fermi interaction, where you had two fermions coming in, two fermions coming out, and if Q squared is very small, which was the case, then this looks like a contact interaction. And if you write it down like that, so if you think about the propagator, then you basically only have that constant 1 over mw, basically. And what happens is that the cross-section just grows with center of mass energy. As you go to a higher energy, remember the propagator has this 1 over p squared minus m squared. Suddenly p squared is not negligible, and that's going to cancel out your s in the numerator. Okay. So then that becomes visible. It cures the problem. Problem solved. So this is a problem. We had a problem like that. You can solve the second one in an analogous way by introducing a new particle, and you basically introduce a propagator. That propagator is called the Higgs. So you introduce a massive spinless particle. This thing has to have mass less than about a TeV, otherwise it doesn't work. Then the cross-section explodes before it can really affect the result. So that would be bad. So that's where basically the upper limit on the Higgs mass comes from. And then the couplings of the W and the Z are fixed, and the quantum numbers are known. It's a particle which has the quantum numbers of the vacuum. This is evil, but fine. Its mass is, in principle, unknown because it's one of the parameters that you write down, which is not constrained by anything else. And its couplings to the fermions are unknown at that stage. However, fermions, as you know, can acquire mass by coupling to this particle. And if so, then you suddenly know all the couplings between the Higgs and all the fermions, and you're done. And this is what is commonly called the standard model Higgs. Okay, so far so good. Right? You all know this. Fine. So if you know that, then you have enough information to determine the Higgs mass. Because then you can do experiments like this one, where you scatter electrons, produce a Z, and the Z can decay to BB bar, and you have a vertex correction with the Higgs. Okay, and you can do the same experiment with this going to mu mu, and you have the equivalent diagram, except that the only difference is now that these two couplings, those two vertices, are different. Right, so you have different things, and so if you measure this with infinite precision, then you can basically measure this thing. And so you can figure out what the Higgs mass is. Okay, so then you get this famous plot. I haven't bothered updating this. Now this number is 157 because of the new W mass and a little bit of improvement in the top mass and things like that. So this is from March. There's a new summer plot. But basically, this is what you get, and you know that this part is excluded from the lab searches, that part is excluded from Tevatron searches now, and you have this open window here, and then basically on that edge you're already too far up. So that's where that plot comes from, and it's good to remember that it has a number of assumptions which are semi-ad hoc. Okay? Note that this is very sensitive to the top quark and W boson masses, but these things by now have stabilized to a degree of precision that this doesn't move anymore, that much anymore. When the top quark mass still moved by about 5 GeV, you could have significant shifts here. In any case, this thing really wants a light Higgs boson. So we had, if we want to fix WW scattering, we need a Higgs boson less than a TeV. If on top of that we believe that the Higgs is the source of fermion masses, and the only source of fermion masses, so that all the couplings are known, then we get this, and we say, well, the Higgs has to have a mass well under 200 GeV. Okay. Good. So, and you've seen this plot, you add 150 or 130 or 140, that funnel plot, you've seen that. And adding that 100 GeV Higgs, particle physics is complete, and you have the equivalent, in a certain sense, of Mendeleev stable for chemistry, in the sense that you have fundamentally understood everything, in a certain sense. You have all the inputs. Well, you haven't really understood them, but that's it. That's the whole picture. That doesn't put particle physics to an end, just like chemistry has still been going strong. By itself, the Higgs has some unsatisfactory aspects to it, because it still doesn't tell you why the couplings to the fermions are what they are. You happen to have 6 fermions or 9 fermions that are coupled to the Higgs, maybe 12, and a certain set of values for these, and why no other values, and so on. Right? So why are these what they are? Is this dumb luck? Maybe. And one can then start invoking landscape ideas, or one cannot. Certainly for the up and down quark, one might want to be careful. What's the link between the Higgs and gravity is a mysterious thing. Why does the Higgs break the symmetry? Why does this mu squared term go negative? Because we haven't really forced that yet. And why are there 3 of everything, and so on and so forth? Any questions? No? Good, because you should all know this. It's okay. Gets worse, and I'm sure I'm not the first one to show you this. Why? Because, well, it gets worse, or maybe it gets better. It depends on your point of view. Maybe I think it gets better at this point. You know that the Higgs couples to all of these particles, there are all of these loops, and because of that, it acquires mass. And you know that all of these terms are quadratically divergent with some couplings that are not small. And so these mass terms, since you have to integrate these loops up to wherever your theory works, lead to some very, very large numbers. Basically, what this means is when you do that integral, the Higgs mass goes to wherever the integral goes to. We believe there's one hard cutoff, which is the Planck mass, the end of the universe, the beginning. Depends on how you look at it. But we know that the Higgs mass has to be less than a TeV. So this is where this conflict comes from. And so one way of turning it is to say, well, I know the Higgs mass is less than a TeV, so I know I have to cut off that integral at a TeV or less. Okay? So new physics has to come in at a TeV. Or you can live with fine-tuning. Okay. So that's where we stand, basically. So, many open questions. A very elegant scheme, but that really doesn't answer many of those questions. So the natural thing to do is to go get more information. And you can do that in many ways. You can measure particles and their interactions in details, and these are typically precision measurements, and you can do flavor measurements and things like that. Gino talked about those, so I'm not going to do that, and I'm sure Sven talked about precision measurements and things like that, a little bit at least. Okay, so that's not... Sorry, yes?
You said that Higgs mass, we expect Higgs mass close to the scale where new physics start, but we expect it at 120 or what?
Okay, I don't believe in the existence of the Higgs, so don't. So, if we're saying, let me rephrase. So, If we are saying, if it is such that the Higgs is the source of the masses of all pure WW scattering and WZ scattering, and it is the source, the unique source of the masses of all fermions, right? Then we know that this particle has to have a mass which is below about 160 GeV. Okay? That means I have to cut off that integral. I have to cut off that integral not too far from 160 GeV. Okay? And something has to come in which says, well, you can't do that. That loop has no more sense. There are other things that come in. Okay? Or you can forget about the fermion couplings, and then the limit is about a TeV, because otherwise you don't solve WW scattering, and you're in real deep trouble. And something has to happen at it by the time you get to a TeV. And you can add, you know, depending on how comfortable you are, a factor of 2 or a factor of 4 or something like that. Or you can say, I don't care, and add a factor of 10 to the 15. That's subjective and a Bayesian problem. Okay. Okay. So I'm not going to talk about precision measurements. The other approach is to try to observe new particles or new interactions, and so you can search in new areas in phase space. Right? In other words, areas where nobody has looked before. That can be at very high energy, that can be at very low energy, that can be at very large distances, that can be in many different ways. The other aspect to this, to this searching for answers, is to try and scratch your head, and there is an obvious pattern in the fermions and the standard model and in the bosons and all of that stuff, and try to figure out what that pattern is. It's quite obvious from the gazillion papers that are out there and the models that are out there that the model is under constraint at this point. There is just not enough information. You can build many models that work, okay? Even if the standard model is precise to such an unbelievable level. You can just build many things that... But there are many hypotheses you can make. You can build models, you can check whether these are consistent in and of themselves, or do they blow up in some part in some type of interaction. Are these consistent with data? And from that, you also get suggestions on where to look when you go back and try to observe things. Okay? So that's experiment and that's theory, and I'll be talking about experiment. So from the experimental point of view, where do you want to start if you want to be minimally biased by the theories that we all have some preference for one or the other? Well, beyond the standard model, physics must couple to the standard model, because otherwise we don't solve anything. So it cannot be completely hidden. Then it's pointless and it's a philosophical argument. And it has to couple to the standard model weakly, because if it coupled strongly, we would have seen something. Right? So it's a tricky, it's a fine line you have to walk at this point. So is it standard model-like? In other words, does it have massive new particles that decay to standard model particles? That's one option. That's the most popular option, certainly, and probably, in a sense, the easiest to pursue. It could be quasi-standard model-like, in the sense that it's similar and it decays, but in the decay chains, there are some new long-lived particles that you may or may not be able to see and things like that. That makes things a little bit more challenging. There may be no new particles in reach. These may be heavy, hidden or too heavy or not exist, and then we're in trouble, and then we have to go and look in detail at some new things. And there's the question whether there are new interactions or not. So, thing to do, go look where the standard model breaks down. A good place to look is high energy, and this is obviously what we're going to try to do with the LHC. You look for subtle anomalies, and I'm not going to talk about that. Certainly, what we're going to assume is that new physics manifestations lead to anomalous production of standard model particles, one way or another. This production can be resonant or not. In other words, it can lead to a nice bump or it cannot. It may only happen in loops, and then it's a little tricky. It can be short-lived. It can be less short-lived. It's clear that, at some extent, you can try to do what is called model-independent searches, but at some level, you have to rely on guidance from models. What are the implications of the known constraints? What signatures are actually allowed? For some signatures, there's no point in looking for them because you can rotate the Feynman diagram and say, well, I've actually already measured them. Okay. There are scenarios that do require a new approach, and I'm afraid I'm not going to have time to talk about that. I only have 2.5 hours. How many have PH articles every day? Okay. So Günther was here, and he talked about this, presumably. At this point in the high energy frontier, the studies are done at colliders. We have stopped doing electron-positron beams for the moment, at least, for the next 2 decades or so. You can collide electrons and protons, and that's going to stop for a while as well. And then you can collide protons and antiprotons, or protons and protons, and that's going to run for the next 2 decades. Okay. The high energy implies that you're probing very, very short distances, right? Higher energy is shorter distance. So it's clear that what we're doing is probing very short distance physics. So there may be other things that you want to do in parallel. This is the Tevatron. Sven talked about this. This is 2 TeV center of mass energy. And on a nice day, if you go to the 16th floor of the high rise, you can actually see the Sears Tower in Chicago. So that's actually worth doing. Say? It has? What world do I live in? Okay. And then there's the LHC, which has a center of mass energy. It'll start at 7. At some point, it'll reach 14, maybe more, maybe less. Who knows at this point? That machine is about ready to go. You're familiar with both of these. Let me remind you of one thing. At hadron colliders, we're not colliding clean particles, and we don't know the incoming longitudinal momentum. So this is one of the things that makes life a little bit harder. So, you know, this is a proton, this is an antiproton, and I didn't draw the gluons and virtual quark-antiquark pairs and things like that. So we collide these two, and it's really maybe that green one that's going to collide with that red one, that anti-green one, if you want, that's going to collide with that red one, and that's going to lead to what we call the hard scatter. Okay? So I'm going to talk about hard scatters. I think we've heard about soft scatters. The other thing that people sometimes forget is that there's an enormous, when we talk about hard scatters, it means that we took a parton here and a parton there, which at least one of them, maybe both, carried a large fraction of the proton's momentum. So we have a very significant boost in the longitudinal direction, and so everything is flattened to a pancake, and the parton model works, lo and behold. Okay? So that's another reason that we work in the plane transverse to the beam. So that any high mass interaction, anything which had a substantial square root of s hat, is just collapsed to a pancake. Okay? So 2 reasons to work in the transverse plane. Yep. Here are a few detectors. Again, Günther must have talked about this. I am involved in D0 and Atlas, so most of the plots I'll show are from these two because these are all things that I have easy access to. All the detectors now are essentially the same, so similar performance with some rare exceptions. And these detectors do well. These are good detectors. The Tevatron detectors were good. The LHC detectors will be better. We do well at detecting basically everything, every particle in the standard model. Okay, we don't have the ability to distinguish between the 3 neutrinos. The tau is a real challenge. But otherwise, we do basically very well at detecting all of it. Okay. So, I'm going to go through a number of topics over whatever time I have left. I'm going to talk about the standard model Higgs search. And the reason I'm going to talk about the standard model Higgs search is not so much the result, because you know all of that. But it is a good example of a small signal, large background search. And it requires that you understand things in great detail. And it will allow me to illustrate a lot of the techniques we apply in these searches. So that's really the reason I'm going to do that, because you know the result. That's not really worth pushing further. So then there's the question, there's this outside thing which I haven't talked about yet, which is the problem of dark matter and particulate dark matter, which is weakly interacting and things like that. So does particle physics need to provide this cold dark matter candidate? There are certainly strong indications now that it's a particle, it's not some big object or something like that. Then you need something which has a massive, stable, neutral, colorless particle, typically, unless you jump through hoops. And a good candidate for that is supersymmetry, so I'll talk a little bit about supersymmetry. But you may be saturated with supersymmetry by now, so not going to spend too much time on that. Then I'll talk about a different approach to the mass problem, because the mass problem is really something which comes from the problem of parity, which comes from the problem that the weak interaction violates parity maximally. So his left-handedness really a low-scale problem only, and then we have a different world on our hands. Or maybe super weak gravity and hierarchy are an illusion, and this takes us in the extra dimensions domain. Then one can argue about searching for anything anomalous, but I'm sure I won't have time for that, so I don't have slides for that. Okay. So, when you talk to people in Geneva, and you want to argue about we should do a new physics search, the first thing they tell you is, yes, but we have to understand this. We have to make sure we understand the standard model first. Okay? So, the Higgs-Antetokounmpo-Tevatron is a real good way of asking the question, do we actually understand the standard model? Okay. Any questions? No questions? Yes.
So I just realized now that the Higgs could be two different mechanisms, one explaining the electroweak symmetry breaking and one given the mass of the leptons, and there's no particular reason why they should be the same. Is that
That's true. Well,
be the
that's
same particle given?
In the standard model, the couplings of the Higgs to the fermions are put in by hand, completely ad hoc. Nothing stops you from setting them to zero. Okay? Switch that off.
So would there be a more basic search for only the electroweak symmetry break in Higgs?
Well, you have to be a little bit careful, because people understand different things, and some people understand electroweak symmetry breaking as all of that, and it's a little bit what you call electroweak symmetry breaking becomes a little tricky if you switch all the Yukawa couplings of the fermions to zero, right? So you still save WZ scattering. You have a fully consistent model, right? And everything is fine in the best of worlds. You will not have explained fermion masses, just like you haven't explained what color or electric charge or stuff like that is. That's just the state you're in. You have one less piece of help. Okay? But in a certain sense, even if you put them in, since the standard model Higgs doesn't tell you why these couplings are what they are, the difference is minor. If I can say it that way. Okay? In terms of understanding what's happened. Which is really what we'd like to do.
But in terms of searches, what do you say?
Well, no, probably not. Well, I think you have to keep on searching. But I think that's true in either case. Because I think that's always true. Because you're going to have to explain the Yukawa couplings because of this. This one is a good one. It's a big one. Okay? And so even if you see the Higgs, you're going to have to figure out why this loop is what is how this loop is canceled out. Okay? Oh, sorry, you don't have that one anymore. Oh, that one's gone. See, you're solving problems as you go. But you have to, it doesn't, you're just missing one more piece of an answer. Yeah?
I believe that also, not only for WW scattering, but also for fermion processes, in the end, we need each boson in order to keep the amplitudes under control. And the nice thing for WW scattering is that the Higgs that you introduce in order to regularize the amplitude of the, yeah, everything, probability below one, is exactly the Higgs that also generates the masses. And the same.
Why?
So I wouldn't.
I think that's true, but
it's. Any attempt to really try to construct two different objects that do the two different.
Yeah, that I don't know of either.
It's very economical to have one object that does it, and you simply write down the terms for the Lagrangian that you can write down, and then.
That's true. No, that's true. You'd need something else. But you need something else anyway. Where were they? Okay. So let me just. I have until what? 6? Okay. Okay. All right. So let me walk you through through the Higgs search at the Tevatron, taking a few examples. The Tevatron experiments currently have the equivalent of about 6 inverse femtobarns of data on tape. Data taking efficiency is about 90%, but that's already in those 6 inverse femtobarns. Right? So we've reached almost 7 inverse femtobarns delivered point. So then you look at this plot of the standard model Higgs production cross-section, which you've seen before, and if I take a Higgs of about 120 GeV, where the cross-section is roughly the highest in the allowed region, the cross-section is about 1 femtobarn. So with 6 inverse femtobarns, I have 6,000 events produced. That's before any type of efficiency factors, anything like that, right? So before data taking efficiency, data taking efficiency is in, but before anything else, 6,000 events in an overwhelming background. Note that if you want to go to WH, for example, then you're paying a factor of 5 or so already in addition in price, and so you're down to 1,200 events at the raw level. So it's not a large number of events. Then it decays, and unfortunately, that particular region, which the standard model fit now likes, is the region where it's a mess. Okay? And so we have at the low end, we still are dominated by BB bar, and then you go up to WW. The good news at the Tevatron is that your statistics are so small that you don't need to worry about any of the other curves in this plot. Okay? There are no events. Forget it. So these are the two curves that drive you. So at low mass, you're looking for Higgs to BB bar. At high mass, you're looking for Higgs to WW. So far, so good. You can't do Higgs to BB bar because of this. So this is this famous plot of the evolution of cross-sections. It's just useful to look at this. Look only at the Tevatron line. And here's the Higgs for 150 GeV. It moves up a teeny-weeny little bit for 120 GeV, not that much. Maybe it moves up to here, and you see that this is BB bar, and this is this, and unless you have absolutely impeccable BB bar mass resolution, you're never going to see a peak over that kind of background. Okay? And you cannot have impeccable BB bar mass resolution because B quarks hadronize. So that story is over before you even put a detector around the beam line. So glue glue to Higgs to BB bar, forget about it. So at low mass, what you have to do is look for associated Higgs, and if you remember that plot before with the WH and ZH, okay, so you pay a price of a factor of 5 in the cross section, but then if it's WH or ZH, you need the W or the Z to decay leptonically. That decay branching ratio is about 10%, so the number of events gets divided by a factor of 50. So I'm down to 120 events. Okay? Haven't done anything yet with my detector, with detecting anything. I'm down to 120 events. At high mass, it's better, because glue glue Higgs to WW is accessible if at least one of the W's decays leptonically. And this is why we currently have sensitivity at the standard model cross-section level at high mass and not at low mass, basically. Okay. So let me do the easy channel. The easy channel is where you have Higgs goes to WW, and each of the W's decays leptonically, right? So I have 2 electrons plus missing ET, or 2 muons plus missing ET, or an electron and a muon plus missing ET. Forget about taus, because our detection efficiency isn't high enough, given the low number of events we have. Okay. You can't completely forget about taus, but the sensitivity is much less. The cool thing about things like this is you can call this the golden channel, because the main background is Z2-dileptron with some missing ET coming from God knows where. And if you do that, well, Z2-dileptons is a fantastic calibration signal, right? Because you just make the invariant mass of 2 electrons, and you see this fantastic curve. And this is the Z resonance. And you have some Di boson contribution. And then you have some fakes from jets faking electrons. You have W plus, which decays to an electron plus something, and then a jet which fakes an electron. That also contributes. And what is this? Ah, this is TT bar. And then this is the 165 GeV Higgs, but Higgs plus X. So that also includes ZH, hence this little peak. And this thing has been multiplied by a factor of 10. So where are we? We're at about, you know, between this and this, say, 1, 2, 3 orders of magnitude plus a factor of 4 orders of magnitude away at this stage. That's the background you have. And again, you have 1,000 events, right? So the cuts you're going to apply to kill 4 orders of magnitude of background have to preserve some amount of those 1,000 events. Okay. Cool thing is that with WW, of course, comes a lot of missing ET, and you don't have that in the Z. So you see that you can apply a simple cut here and already get rid of a large amount of background. So that's good news. Piece of cake. Then you can use angles, and now we're going to use the fact that the thing is spin zero. In Z2 dileptons, the charged lepton, the Z is typically produced roughly at rest, so the two leptons go back to back. So that's what you see here. This is the azimuthal angle between the two leptons. Ah, but in Higgs, it's a little bit different, right? So the Higgs is scalar, so the two W spins have to be back to back, right? And so the two W spins are these two black arrows here. But one is a W plus and one is a W minus. So one is going to give me a positron, and it has to be right-handed. And the other one is going to give me an electron, which has to be left-handed, right? It's pure V minus A. And so the spins of the leptons are going to be oriented in these directions. And then because the spins are that way, and one is left-handed and the other one is right-handed, they both have a tendency to go in the same direction. Okay? So that's what you see when you simulate it. So it tells you that the theorists did their job. It's in there. And indeed, the dileptons from Higgs decay tend to be, this is a log plot, right? So even this light slope is really quite substantial. So this tells you that the two charged leptons like to be emitted in the same direction. So this is another good cut, because again, this is a log plot, so you could cut here and get rid of a lot of background. Good variable, this. Smallest transverse mass. Should I talk about this? Oh, forget it. Okay. So I don't want to give a seminar on the Higgs search either. So you see that you apply some preselection where you require two leptons because that's what we're after. You apply some missing transverse energy requirement because that worked very well, as I showed you. And then you apply also this a cut on this delta phi. And then it's a little bit more complicated because we don't measure high PT muons that well, and it's easy to create artificial missing ET and things like that. So you get into all of these experimental considerations of not wanting to apply a dry cut to a variable you don't measure that well. And so you build these things. This is a better missing ET. And you build these things in the dimuon channel. Instead of just cutting on missing ET, you cut on different things. Okay. And then this is what you end up with after those pre-selection cuts. And these are plots that are made where we just took out the one cut that I'm illustrating. So this is the missing ET and the dielectron cuts when you apply all of the cuts except the missing ET cut. And you see that that has reduced many things, and basically you've been able to kill that Z background in a very good way because it's already reduced by, after beyond missing ET of 20, there is just very little Z background left over. Again, the signal is multiplied by a factor of 10. This is this delta phi angle. This is in the EMU channel. In the EMU, you have no Z, very little Z background, and very little background anyway. That's an easy channel. If you're going to do something at the LHC in the early days, do something going to an electron in a muon. Right? You can almost do that with your eyes closed. Okay. So after this preselection, which seemed very effective in all of these plots, but I've had to pay some price in signal, what am I left with? The signal of a background is not good, but by design in a certain sense. It's 1 over 30, 1 over 50, 1 over 1,000 in each of the three channels. Okay, still not good. This is not something that you can hope to find, do a discovery with at small statistics. So then what we do is we use multivariate tools to exploit the correlations between the observables. And you're going to talk about multivariate tools, so I'm not going to do that. In the dielepton plus missing ET channel, the multivariate tool of choice is a neural net. The neural nets are going out of fashion at this point. And then you have to be careful, you know, when you have, because you use Monte Carlo samples to train the neural nets, and you can't use, and then you have to verify that it does the right job. So you have to split your Monte Carlo samples. Good way to do that is even events in training, odd events in test. Okay. As opposed to about 10 years ago, when people really started using neural nets, the claim was you shouldn't use more than 4 or 5 variables. Today, in this neural net, there are order 15 variables. and you throw out everything and you're wincing, and you're throwing out everything that you don't model well. Which is kind of a funky thing to do in a certain sense, because we're saying, okay, we have these variables which we model really, really well. Look, my data Monte Carlo agreement is fantastic, right? If I go back, show you, oops, sorry. Right? Data Monte Carlo agreement in this plot is amazing, right? This plot is not a smooth distribution. It has all these funky bumps and things like that, and it's there. It's just there. It's amazingly good, right? So we have all these things, and we take only the variables which we are well modeled, and we're going to exploit the correlations between these variables, and we're going to throw out the variables which we believe, which we know are not well modeled, assuming that those don't have correlations with the variables that are well modeled. So there's a bit of a catch in there. So you put all of that in, you run your neural net, and again, the signal is this red curve. It's been multiplied by 10. It's for 165 GeV. And you see that that goes to 1. The backgrounds goes to 0. That's very nice. And all of these curves are, again, data Monte Carlo agreement is very good. Then you can sum all of these up, subtracting out the backgrounds, and this is the distribution you end up with. So this is the neural net output summed for all of these things. The red is the Higgs signal, now not multiplied anymore. So you see that it's not negligibly small. And you see, though, that in that signal region, you have a bit of a deficit. Okay? And this is going to explain why the limit is a little bit better than the expected one. Okay. A little bit of a deficit here, which encourages a negative Higgs cross-section, if you want. Okay. So this is not that hard an analysis. It's going to get much harder afterwards, but let me say a few words about systematics. So, systematics is a tricky question. And really, what you want to do, if you had an infinite amount of manpower, you would go to control samples and you would measure them, right, one by one. You would find a sample where you're confident that there is no signal of any type, that you understand the physics very well, and you would go and measure your systematics. That's a little bit of a waste of manpower, because you already have that low background sample in your data. It's the low end of your neural net output where there was no signal. Okay? So maybe you can extract it. So we do the same thing. We use the profile likelihood to extract further constraints on our initial estimates of the systematics. And we call that systematics profiling. So obviously, when you do your systematics and you finish your analysis with the this is your final distribution, what you do is, well, okay, I'm going to take, say, I'm uncertain about the jet energy scale, and I have some idea of what my uncertainty is. I'm going to move it up by 1 sigma. I'm going to repeat the whole analysis. I'm going to get a new neural net output distribution, okay? And I'm going to be able to compare that to the one I get. This is where that blue curve comes from. Okay. So we repeat for each of our systematics, we repeat the analysis with 1 sigma deviation in what, where 1 sigma is what we believe to be our systematic uncertainty. Some of the systematic uncertainties affect the shape of this distribution, things like jet energy scale, reconstruction efficiency, because those depend strongly on PT and have strong influences on missing ET and things like that. Others are just only have an effect on the normalization, like the theoretical cross-sections is obvious. Right? That just changes the whole normalization of things. Luminosity is the same thing. And we treat systematic uncertainties as nuisance parameters. You've heard about this. And then these nuisance parameters tend to be correlated, but they tend to be correlated at something less than 100%. And it depends from one background to another that correlation may be different. Here's a toy example of how this might work. It's again something which we call final variable here. This could be a neural net output. And there are two big backgrounds. One is kind of flat in the neural net output. This means that the neural net is doing a shitty job. And the other one, the neural net is doing a good job. Okay? And these points are the data in my toy example. And I've derived from what I believe to be the systematic uncertainties a shape systematic for the signal, and then here's one for the second background, and I didn't put on the first background. Okay. Now, what I can do is I can generate pseudo experiments. So in each bin of my neural net output distribution, I'm going to treat each bin one by one. Each bin is distributed like a Poisson. Okay? So generate pseudo experiments with the mean given by the mean of the with the mean given by the mean I expect. And for each experiment like this, I can vary the nuisance parameters within what I believe to be the uncertainties. So the variations in the background and the I get variations like that in the background and the signal plus background distributions. Okay. And I compare these results to the data using the log likelihood ratio. So what is that going to do? You can now maximize the likelihood ratio as a function of the nuisance parameters to try to extract some information about the nuisance parameters. So you use the full shape of this neural net output distribution and its variation according to systematics to see which background uncertainties are over or underestimated. That's basically what we do. Of course, you know, if your thing says something is better constrained as a statistical fluctuation, you have a problem and you know your code is wrong. And if you're concerned, you can remove bins with large signal over background and just go into the background region. This may be important if you have uncertainties that really lead to similar shape distortions. And of course, my toy example was constructed to have large mistakes in the systematic uncertainties. We did that on purpose. So we built data which was constructed to disagree with the background-only hypothesis, but to disagree even more with the signal plus background hypothesis. Okay? And then you have an improvement which is quite spectacular, but again, this is by construction. So here are a number of these systematic uncertainties, and it tells you that you really overestimated these two. Okay? You chart the cross-sections of the two backgrounds. And then since those you really overestimated, of course, the systematic uncertainties are attenuated by large factors, and without the fit, you had systematic uncertainties at the 17% level, and with the fit, they go down to a very small number. But again, this is, you know, by construction. You're never going to get an improvement like that in real data, unless you really screwed up your systematic estimate. So having done all of that, you get your dilepton plus missing ET result. Again, this is really not the hardest analysis in the world. Once you understand your detector a little bit. And we present the result. This is this famous plot that maybe I should have had a standard search plot before where things are not renormalized. So this is the standard model Higgs cross-section. Okay, and I just normalized that to 1. Okay, that's the standard model Higgs cross-section, which normally depends on the mass, and I just take that dependence out, so it's 1. Okay? So typically what we do is we set limits on a cross-section. We say, we have not observed anything. This is the quality of our experiment. We have so much data, and so on and so forth. So we say that the cross-section for this process is smaller than a certain number. If the cross-section for a certain process is smaller than a certain number, and that number is smaller, and that number is smaller than the prediction from the standard model, that prediction is excluded. Okay? Or some model. Anyway, so this is what you get. And you see really that in this range, remember that the neural net had some excess, had some deficit in the signal region. And so you're doing a little bit better because the data fluctuated in your favor. Okay? So the observed limit, which is that black curve, is better than the expected limit, which is the expected limit is the result you get if what you observe is exactly the background you expect. Right? If there was no luck involved in your experiment, you made no mistakes, there was no such thing as statistical fluctuations, you would see exactly what you expected, and then you get that expected curve. Okay? The observed, well, there are statistical fluctuations. Sometimes you're lucky, sometimes you're not. Here we're lucky, here we're not. Okay. So that's that. But as I said, dileptons are really not very hard. It can get much harder. The final state consisting of W plus 2 jets is a critical piece of the Higgs search. And it's a real problem. At low mass, you have WH with Higgs going to BB bar, and so you have these two jets are B jets, and their mass is the Higgs mass. At high mass, you have Higgs going to WW, And if one of the two W's decays hadronically, then you get that two jets, right? And you want to be able to include that mode, because if both W's decay leptonically, that's a small branching ratio, right? So including the semi-leptonic mode is really valuable. So MWW has to be MH, with MJet jet being one of the W's. Now, note that dijet mass resolution is just not very good, because jets hadronize, plus when jets are stopped in a detector, they lose energy through strong interactions, right? So a lot of that energy goes into nuclei, and that's not visible. You can do whatever you want. You cannot observe that energy. It's invisible. So what detectors do, a really well-built detector will see about 40-50% of a jet's energy, right? And we multiply it up by a factor of 2. So that's why our jet mass resolution is just not very good. So here's the Higgs bump multiplied by a factor of 10, and that's for a Higgs at 120 or at 115, and you see that it's 50 GeV wide, basically. And this is with already a B-tag, and there's a lot more background than there was in the dilepton channel. So let me talk a little bit about how this analysis proceeds. Your typical analysis is, okay, I do a pre-selection, which tends to like to select events of my signal and reduces the background a lot. That's called the pre-selection level. At that stage, you have low signal over background, but that's a good thing, because at that stage, you can verify whether you understand the background, so you can check whether the distributions you see in data agree with your expectation. So for the WH search, you do that first before B-tagging, then with one tag, and it's really in the two tags that you're going to be sensitive to the Higgs. So thing to do, though, is to determine what all the contributions to your sample are. So you have to determine the composition, and at a hadron collider, this is how you're going to do that. Dibosons are small, and it's purely electroweak, and we know we can calculate purely electroweak at multiple loops, so we're happy to take that from Monte Carlo simulation. Top, we take from simulation at the Tevatron, because at the Tevatron, top is relatively small. At the LHC, this is not going to work. At the LHC, we're going to have to find a way to extract the TT-bar background from the data. Z plus jets at the Tevatron, and I'll show you this, we extract from a combination of data in Monte Carlo, because we can get a clean sample in the data, and then we can compare that to the Monte Carlo, and then we can correct the Monte Carlo. QCD multijet we get from data because we have no choice. There's no way we can ever produce enough QCD events. And W plus jet events we get from Monte Carlo, but the same deficiencies are present in Z plus jets and W plus jets. So it gets increasingly difficult as you go down that line. Torbjörn talked about this, I assume. We use four kinds of Monte Carlo generators. We have things that I'll call calculators, which are often nowadays next to leading order, sometimes next to next to leading order. And these things don't generate events, but they can calculate some of the distributions that we have. And some of them have these non-perturbative resummation issues and things like that, which are really cool. And so you can calculate the WPT with those things over the whole range, and that's very useful. There's the traditional Pythia and Herwig 222 generators. Those are leading order things, and those include the parton shower. The problem with those things is that, Torbjörn must have said it, it's very hard to generate the fourth jet as hard as you see it in data, because it has to come from the parton shower. You have no other way, and the parton shower is ordered, so it gets smaller and smaller. It's hard to do, although they're getting better at it. So we have these matrix element generators, which are 2 to n leading order generators, so they can do a process like QQ bar to E nu jet, 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 jet. Okay? And then, so you need this if you want to have many hard jets. And then what you have to do is put this through a parton shower. Okay? And then you have this whole problem of matching, which is really a major issue at this point when you want to do precision physics, as you'll see. Okay, and then we have these next to leading order with parton showers 2-to-2 generators like MC at NLO or PowHag. These include next to leading order corrections, virtual corrections, and things like that. So in a sense, these are 2-to-2 and 2-to-3 with the virtual corrections. And those kind of do well still in the 2-to-4 domain. Now, none of these things are perfect, right? Unfortunately, the best way we've found to calculate physics processes is Feynman diagrams. And Feynman diagrams have no relationship with reality, okay? Feynman diagrams are, you know, leading order or maybe higher order type stuff. reality is infinite order, right? And so Feynman diagrams, well, they have some relationship with reality, obviously, because it works at some level. But this is not what the world is made of, right? Okay, you have to remember that. So the matrix element generators are leading order. So those are things that if I'm going to look at W plus 2, 3 jets, I need these things. And they're leading order, so I need to apply K factors. And K factors can be different for heavy flavor and so on and so forth. So we have all these correction factors that we have to apply to these matrix element generators to make them look like the data. And some are known from theory. I have K factors. Those are known because I can run the next to leading order calculator, and I can take the ratio as a function of some variable and apply that. And that works very well. And then I have things which are empirical, which we observe we need. In addition to all of that, there's W and ZPT reweighting because nobody can get that right. So then we do that and we go and look for a clean sample, and Z plus jets is one because we can get rid of most. There's very little QCD background. We know how to extract it and things like that. This is not very hard to do. Well, it takes a little bit of work, a few years. So you can get a clean sample and you can check if the simulation reproduces the data. And here are a couple of plots. Okay, that's a little tricky. I don't like the way these are presented. So let me look at the left-hand side first. So this is the PT distribution of the Z. And the black points with the yellow blob that indicates the uncertainty are the data. Okay? And then the red dashed line is AlpGen, one of the matrix element generators. And the blue line is next to leading order perturbative QCD, MCFM, with some correction. And you see that the blue line does fine, but it's not plotted here because it doesn't do well there. It's not supposed to do well there. And then you go to the lower thing, and unfortunately now the lines with the same colors have different meanings. Okay. So here's the data. Yellow is now data over AlpGen. Blue is now next to leading order perturbative QCD over AlpGen. And what you're trying to find is something that matches one of these curves. The red is Sherpa. So you see that Sherpa doesn't do very well in the ZPT, at least Sherpa version 1.1 or something like that. And then the green is Pythia over AlpGen. Okay, so that's not so good. But you can say, well, I measured this distribution. Let me just reweight the Monte Carlo to all of this. This is the rapidity distribution of the jets, okay, on the right-hand side. And again, the top plot is the same. So this is the data, this is MCFM, and this is AlpGen. And you see that AlpGen has a very different behavior. And you see that yellow, which is here, data over AlpGen, has a curve to it, which is really not very nice because it's not easy to correct for that. When it's flat, that's nice. I can just apply a flat K factor and I'm happy. And I'm not too worried about correlations. This is bad. And you see, interestingly enough, that Sherpa gets the angles right. So it has the right behavior in the angular thing. It has the wrong behavior in the PT, the right behavior in the angles, and AlpGen vice versa. Okay, so what do you do now? Well, if you were interested in Z's, you can just measure it and you're done. So after all of this, I apply K, K prime, S, A, blah, blah factors, and then boson PT reweighting. And let me mention that I can take the boson PT reweighting from the ZPT to reweight the AlpGen Monte Carlo, except that the ZPT is different from the WPT because the W and Z masses are different by 10 GeV. And that's reflected in a different number of jets and things like that. So actually, it doesn't work doing this. But it's the best we can do at this point. And then you look at all of this, and you have, again, the same. This is basically similar to the other distribution I've shown you. It's quite clear that the Monte Carlo has a different distribution for the angles. And it's interesting that the theorists see the same thing. Because when our friends that develop matrix element generators make that same comparison between AlpGen and a bunch of others, here Sherpa, Mad Event, and so on, then they see, indeed, that, look, these with the little blue round and the green thing, unfortunately, they cut off the plot at 2. It would have been really nice if they went to 3. You see that they see a similar rise here. So it has a distribution, a ratio, which is indeed more like what we see there. So that's kind of cool. They see the same thing. And then maybe you're thinking, oh, we're starting to understand something. And the best indication I have that we're understanding something is that all of these that are flat here in the ratio that look not like data are AlpGen, Mad Event, and Hellac, and they use this MLM matching scheme. Tobian described MLM, right? I don't need to tell you about that. He did, right? You remember what MLM is? Okay. And Sherpa and Ariane use this thing which is called CKKW matching, which is really the way you should be doing it. But it's just much harder to implement. Okay? MLM is kind of funny, right? Because any theorist that does QCD, if you go and talk to these people and you're saying, yeah, but I really want to match a jet to a parton, they will tell you that makes no physical sense. A jet doesn't exist without its algorithm and so on and so forth. This is crap what you're doing. You can't do that, right? But this is exactly what MLM does, right? It matches a jet to a parton. Okay. Anyway. Yeah, I don't know how to... Well... Yeah, let me skip this. Nobody cares about the result, right? Matrix element techniques. Matrix element techniques. Do I have time for that? Yeah, let me... Well, no. Yes. Okay, let me be quick about that. Matrix element techniques. This is really a very interesting thing to do, because it yields the most precise measurement of the top quark mass, and if you're a theorist, you use the top quark mass for a lot of things as inputs to your fits, right? So the top quark mass is a very important parameter. So this is really also, it's a major contribution to the observation of single top, and it's actually used in the Higgs searches to help boost the sensitivity. Basically what a matrix element technique is, it's really an unfortunate name they chose. It's an unbinned maximum likelihood fit. So it uses every event with the uncertainties on every event, which are measured. So it uses event by event basis. You're going to get a weight, and events that look much more like signal are going to get a bigger weight in your final fit than events that look kind of like background. Okay, that's what you want to do. Instead of just having your sample of all events treated evenly, things that are very cleanly measured and look like signal get a lot of weight. Things that, you're not quite so sure, gets a lot less weight. That's what an unbinned maximum likelihood fit is. So now, for each event, however, you're going to have to take the matrix element, which somebody has calculated for you, and look at all the four vectors coming out and use transverse functions to convert the generated momenta of the outcoming partons to things that you can see in your detector, and so on and so forth. Sum it over beta probabilities, and so on and so forth. Okay, these are structure functions, obviously. So you do that, and that helps a lot. The caveat with matrix elements, first of all, is that, again, this is a leading order tree-level Feynman diagram, right? So, again, its resemblance to reality is as good as the leading order is. So you need to require the exact number of jets. You cannot afford to go to the next one. There is talk of how to evaluate the next to leading order systematic on these things, and there's a lot of talk. It's not so obvious what the right answer is. There's a recent development where people replace MAD event with MCFM because even you deal with weighted events, but fine, there is some hope of doing something at next leading order. And then you use the matrix element output, which is something like this if it does its job. It produces some discriminant. It's kind of a big likelihood function if you want. And imprint signal is at 1, and the background tends to go the other way. WH here is multiplied by a factor of 10, but you see that you can do something. Of course, the background here is fairly small because I've already asked for 2 betas. Okay, well, small. Still bigger than in the dilepton case. This boosts the sensitivity so we go through all of this work, and this takes a lot of CPU power because you have to generate a gazillion little Monte Carlo events for this. But it boosts the sensitivity by a factor of 1.05 for WH. So we're that desperate. Okay? 1.05 is worth 5 graduate students' lives for 5 years. Okay. That's the quantification. Because it's equivalent to 10% more data. You plug the matrix element output into the neural net input. So you're starting to sequence multivariate things. Then at the end, you're going to put this in a boosted decision tree. Okay. These are the neural net outputs. This is W plus 2 jets with no B tags. You don't expect to see anything. You don't see anything. This is a control plot to show you that the distribution does fine. And you can use these things, for example, if you want to use controls, for example, in the dilepton, you do this here. You can do that as well. You can make an attempt at measuring the top quark cross section with these things as a cross check. Right? And generally, you find the right number. I think actually the Higgs analysis in Higgs to W to dilepton has a more accurate of the top quark cross section than the dedicated top to dilepton. Okay, 2 BTAG neural net output WH is still multiplied by 10, so you see it's really hard, right? Because he used this by a number of 10, and by a factor of 10, and there's just no way you can get at this. Okay. So you use the distribution to constrain the systematics using the systematics profiling I was talking about, and you set the limit using the full shape of the distribution. So it's not like you say, well, let me cut here and just count the number of events. You use the full shape of the distribution because there's information there. Because even here, there is some signal. You don't want to lose that. Again, 5-10% gain. So you combine all channels, you've seen this, CDF and D0, and here, thanks to the fact that we were a little bit lucky and we got a little bit of a deficit in data, we excluded from 160 to 170 GeV. The irony would have been if we doubled the data set and we didn't get lucky and this moved back up. We got lucky in the other direction. Okay? That actually happened for a different analysis. Okay. Note that the average luminosity used here is 2.5 in those femtobarns, so it's not all that much. So, back to the thing, the reason I've been talking about the Higgs for half an hour. Do we understand the standard model? And in the end, I'm saying that this is not a good question to ask. The real question that you should ask when you're going to do analysis at the LHC is how well, being the crucial point, do we understand data versus standard model agreement? Okay? And given that, you can say, okay, given the level at which I understand the data versus standard model agreement, which measurements can I make? Some I probably cannot make. And what do I need to do to improve our understanding? This problem with W plus Jets Monte Carlo is not something we're going to solve in a detector. It's something that's going to require help from other people, from theorists that know what they're doing, and so on. Right? So we need to balance the work between early low background searches and a detailed understanding verification of the standard model predictions. And it's going to be hard at the LHC because as many problems as we have with vector boson plus jets at the Tevatron, we're going to have that with TT-bar at the LHC. Okay. Supersymmetry. 15 minutes for supersymmetry, maybe. Okay. Let me irritate Sven a little bit. So I'll call this postponing the hierarchy problem. If there is a Higgs, new particles at a level at a mass which is similar to the Higgs mass is a good way to stabilize its mass, right? If you pick the quantum numbers and the couplings the right way, you can cancel out all the loops, which is fabulous. This is really a magnificent fact of gauge theories, I guess. So in supersymmetry, this is the easiest and certainly most elegant way of doing this. The fermionic and bosonic loop corrections, you know, Bose-Einstein versus Fermi-Dirac, you couldn't have invented it that well if you were building up the standard model yourself, right? It's just fantastic, or physics itself. So this compensates for that. They cancel out modulo the difference between the top and the stop masses, and all of this works, and the world is beautiful. And this truly is fantastic because with supersymmetry, since you have the partners for every particle, all of these are done in one go. It's beautiful. Little Higgs models do something similar, except that you don't automatically have all the partners, so you need to invent one for each. So you need to invent a partner for the top, you need to invent a partner for the W, you need to invent a partner for, and so on, and then at some point you say, okay, the next one correction is very far away, it's the next order of magnitude, so we'll just hold off. And so up to 10 TeV, you're happy. You can push them further if you wanted to, there's just no real point. Okay. The minimal supersymmetric standard model, of course, comes at a bit of a price. The minimal new set of particles, you know, and you have 105 new free parameters, although Gino argued with you that a lot of these are known to be small, cannot be large. That still doesn't tell us why they are small. Typically, searches in supersymmetry make simplifying assumptions. So our parity conservation is typically either assumed or explicitly violated. You look for an explicit violation of our parity in one explicit term in the our parity violating Lagrangian, and I have no time to talk about that further. So what you do is you search for pair production of one type of superpartner, and one way, the simplest version, is where that thing decays to its standard model partner plus whatever the lightest supersymmetric particle is. Or if you go to a higher energy machine, we already know that at the Tevatron, we're not going to be able to have decay chains, right? At the LHC, 30 years ago, we wouldn't have known that. We don't know that at the LHC. So at the LHC, you have to worry about more complicated decay chain where you, chains where you have multiple particles being emitted. Right? That needs a more complex model, and that leads to interesting kinematic relations. And so what you're going to end up with is jets and or leptons plus missing ET because the LSP you don't see. So this is the typical SUSY search. This is one of the easiest. This comes from LEP. This is pair production of smuons. So you have E plus, E minus going to smu plus, smu minus through S channel gamma star Z. So you assume the smuon is the NLSP, and it goes to a muon plus the LSP. So you're looking, because now instead of going E plus E minus to mu mu, you're going E plus E minus to mu mu, nothing, nothing. Right? The two muons are not back-to-back. So that's the signature. Two muons that are not collinear, and therefore, by definition, some missing momentum. Okay. And LEP was a wonderful machine. And so there's a kinematic. This is the mass of the smuon, and this is the mass of the neutralino. And this thing cannot be heavier than the smuon, so that's excluded. And then you have this whole region where you're sensitive, and this is the edge of the kinematic limit, basically. And then you see this very, very narrow sliver, right? And look at that scale. That's like a couple of GeV at best. And that's because you're in a detector where you can make sure that you're not missing anything at the GeV to GeV level. You're in an environment where you just can close that box. So that's pretty much excluded. So you know that things, you know, these things have to be heavier than 100 GeV, or they have to decay in a different way. Okay. Let me go to the Tevatron and make things a little bit more interesting. Let's start thinking about tops quarks. Okay, so if PP bar going to a gluon, which goes to a stop bar, and then the stop, I assume, is lighter than the top. Okay? So it cannot decay to a top and a neutralino. So then what happens? Well, it has to go in a different way. And the easiest, the most natural way is to do the same thing that the top does. Right? So it decays to, say, a B and a W, a weno. Right? This is mixed, but fine. So it's now a chargino. And that goes to a lepton and a neutrino. Okay? And so what we're looking for is the three-body decay chain, which we, in our friendliness, call BL-SNU. The SNU you don't see. Okay, this is true if the chargino is heavy, and then this is a three-body decay. If the chargino is lighter than the stop, then you get a two-body decay, and it changes the kinematics a little bit. But still, you can look for this decay chain. You have the one catch is that the PTs become small if this difference in mass between the stop and the neutrino is small, because I don't have much energy to spend. The Qs are small. Right? So there's going to be a limit to what we can do, because we cannot, at the Tevatron, detect a 5 GeV B quark. Okay. This is a cool channel. As I said, one electron plus one muon is, you know, it doesn't get much better than that. At a Hadron collider. This is the missing ET distribution. Signal A, signal B, those are two different points in the different in masses between the stop and the neutrino. You use the missing ET, the lepton plus missing ET angles to reduce the backgrounds, and you end up with this. And this is a very similar plot to the plot that we had for smuons, except this is the stop mass, this is now this neutrino mass, and you see LEP still had this beautiful thing. It's basically the same number all the time when you do these types of analyses. 100 GeV is the kinematic limit, and you basically close that gap very well. And then here's the Tevatron exclusion, and what do you see? Well, you have much higher reach. Okay, that's expected. You just have more center of mass energy. But you cannot fill this gap. And that's because we have too much background to be able to detect a 5 GeV or something like that. So this is going to be very hard to do at a Hadron machine. Now, okay, let me go to a slightly... let me make things a little bit more complicated. We know that SUSY is broken. We don't see scalar electrons. Okay. At 511 keV. So we need to break it, and there are breaking models. And breaking models lead to predictions for mass hierarchies. And typically, people like to take parameters at the unification scale. This happens to be M. Sugra, which is a very popular but quite definitely wrong model. But that's OK. All models are wrong, right? We certainly didn't have one where we picked the exact parameters and things like that, right? The question is whether one of them has some reasonable degree of correspondence to what nature actually did. And then, so you have these masses, and then you run these things down to the electroweak scale, and you come out with a set of predictions for particle masses. And because in SUSY there are no new interactions, you know all the couplings, you now can predict everything that's going to happen in your detector. So that gives you, the hierarchies gives you specific phenomenologies. And by the way, you point that out already, SUSY is cool because it explains electroweak symmetry breaking, because this mu squared term from the Higgs potential is driven negative. That's cool. You actually learn something. You now understand something. Electroweak symmetry is broken because the top quark is heavy. If the top quark were light and SUSY is real, electroweak symmetry breaking will not be broken. Okay. It didn't change. The typical search is JETS plus missing ET. This is hard. This is very hard. At Hadron colliders, because we start with color, we're going to produce mostly quarks and gluinos, if these are in reach. So these things, then quarks and gluinos, will decay to quarks, gluons, and LSPs. And if the decay chain is long, maybe you get lucky and there are a few leptons in the decay chain. Okay. Now, experimentally, unfortunately, this is while this is the main signature, experimentally, this is very hard. Why? Well, first of all, we're building the most complex devices that exist. And we can build them like that because, as opposed to the space shuttle, we don't have to launch it in space and make sure it survives. If something breaks, well, we'll go in and fix it when we get a chance, right? So we can afford to have more complexity. So we built the most complex devices there are. But so because of that and the fact that things break all the time, it's very easy to take bad data. So there's an easy part to bad data. It's that, some part of the detector switched off. So you need to make sure that all of that works and that badly behaving channels are identified early and so on. And this is why you put a lot of effort into data quality, because nobody can do anything with bad data. The other catch is that, as I explained, we cannot measure JETS very precisely, and that's part of nature. There's nothing you can do about this. So data quality is a big deal, and you start by doing that online with event displays, occupancy plots, and things like that, and you reconstruct a small fraction of the events, you make sure that the JSI mass is where you expect it to be, and things like that. But anything that happens at a rate which is below a percent is basically impossible to detect online. There's just no way. So unless you know what to look for. So if you keep track, LEP had this problem with the TGV. There are TV programs, there are multitudes of cron jobs. If somebody starts welding 500 meters away at home, that's a major amount of RF radiation, that screws up your detector, and so on. And so continuous feedback from analysis is a necessity, and really subtle stuff really can take years to find. And I'll show you a little bit of that. This is a plot that's gone around a lot. This is from V0, but this really only shows the easy stuff. So the problem with JETS and missing ET in general, is that missing ET relies heavily on good behavior of the calorimeter. And calorimeters are fantastic devices. They are the best antennas mankind has ever built. Okay? Because they are big, and they have 16-bit precision. Okay? So they have enormous dynamic ranges. And they are big, and typically, and they have a lot of metallic things going on, and it's all analog. So this is really hard to do. Basic data quality is easy, and certainly you can't spot something that happens once a month or once a day online. Forget it, not going to happen, unless you know what to look for. But once you've made your cuts and you have required 100 GeV of missing ET, this is actually what you see, right? Okay, and every time you increase the data set, you find a new source of rare noise. This is a beautiful event. This was recorded in 2004. This is a very clean event. You see that it has two beautiful hard jets and nothing going away. And here are the ones in the other direction, in the other display, and it's just a beautiful event. Best guess, this is Z to nu nu bar plus two jets. Best guess. It could also be TT bar going to leptons with both leptons hitting the cracks. Sorry? Yellow line here is missing transverse energy. So that just balances this jet, right? You see it's at pi and phi. Here's another event. The problem with jet algorithms is that they look for blobs of energy. So this is a big blob of energy. This we call the Spanish fan. We get one a year. But it's always the same cells, right? And we're pretty sure we know what it is because the high voltage lines in D0 go around like that. Okay. So it's a fluke on the high voltage line. Okay. But it's guaranteed to trigger, it's guaranteed to end up in the large missing ET sample. And the first one you see after 1 year of data, well, you know, unless you make the event display, you think it's a genuine event, right? So as always, if you want to do things like this, you have to maximize the sensitivity by treating different signals separately. If you're going to reconstruct, say, taus, you should separate every tau decay one by one, right? If you want to do it right. Here, if you're going to search for squarks and gluinos, well, you should search for squarks. You should search for squark and gluino and for gluinos. Why? Because a squark decays to a quark plus a neutralino, so it's two jets in missing ET. This, the gluino, ends up leading to, what's that? Ooh, there's a one. Ah, okay. So you end up with three jets in missing transverse energy. And if you have two gluinos, you'll end up with at least four jets. Okay? So these are different signatures. And if you want to optimize the searches for these things, you need to optimize the analysis. So different triggers, different cuts, and so on and so forth. And because it's the same center of mass energy, here every object is going to have a little bit less energy than they are going to have here. Dominant backgrounds, jets plus missing ET. If you did your job right, it's Z to nu nu bar plus jets, and W to L nu plus jets where the lepton is not detected, like the muon slips through the cracks, TT bar and things like that, if you've cleaned up the bad data. Yeah, I need to find a good place to stop. I'll find one. But I'm close, I think. Okay. And if you reduce the QCD background through delta phi cuts and things like that. Because you don't measure jets very well, you cannot, you're limited. Sometimes you're going to way over multiply. One jet is going to deposit 100% of its energy in the visible, right? It's going to happen. It fluctuates. This is quantum mechanics, right? And you're going to multiply it up by a factor of 2. So suddenly, if this was a hard jet, you've generated 100 GeV of missing ET. There's really nothing you can do about that. Okay. So you have to require that missing ET is not aligned with one of the jets. There's no way out. That's just resolution. Nothing you can do about it. And people who predict signals where the missing ET is always aligned with jets, there's really not much we can do about those. So these are the three different analyses, and you see, oh, we don't really care about the results, right? Okay. So let me explain. So this is the, I'm going to use, for those of you that still don't understand the Higgs exclusion plot, here's the simpler version of those plots. This is what we do. So this is the non-normalized version. These are the three analyses. They're basically three times the same plot. Okay? So this is as a function of one parameter of relevance, the square gluino mass in this case. And this is the cross-section. And the experimental result is saying, because I don't see any event here, I say that the cross-section, anything that produces more events, so has a larger cross-section than this number, is excluded. Okay? So that's the excluded cross-section. Anything above that is excluded. And then on the same plot, you plot the theory curve. This is, in the other plot, the Higgs cross-section. And you see where those two intersect, and you say, well, anything with a square gluino mass below 390 here is excluded. Okay? Done. Over with. In the Higgs exclusion plot, what we've done is that that thing, we've flattened out. We've normalized to 1. Okay? And then this curve can have a funky shape. The result, when you talk about squarks and gluinos at the Tevatron, you have a reach up to about 400 GeV in each. And then it depends. Then you become model, that's semi-model independent. Then you go to MSUGRA, you pick a certain point. Then it says, oh, well, but any gluino lighter than that is excluded as well under certain relational hypotheses between the gluino and the squark masses. Okay? In the pure model, what you're saying is below 400 GeV, there's no such thing. And then you can translate this squark gluino to M0, M1 half, which we're maybe more familiar with. And what that says is, oh, okay, well, here's the newly excluded area, and that's added to the lep limit on sleptons and the lep limit on charginos. Okay? So it goes a little bit further. And look at what the numbers are, just to remind yourself. M1 half, right? So these are fermionic things. You have a reach up to about 150 GeV, but it goes all the way in M0 in this case. Okay. And should I stop here? Yeah, why don't I stop here? Okay, why don't I stop here for today?
Okay. So if there are any questions?
Yeah. Do you believe in supersymmetry?
But what I believe is really not all that relevant. I wasn't there when the universe was created. And this is the thing, right? If you do a good experiment, it shouldn't depend strongly on your prior. And so whether I believe in supersymmetry or not is not very relevant. I have developed a moderate dislike for the model. Let me say it that way. It reminds me a lot of dinosaurs on Venus, and if you don't know what dinosaurs on Venus comes from, I can explain that over dinner.
Can you go to the previous slide? If you measure the data, exactly match what the prediction would be with Susie, how would you convince yourself that your standard model background is accurately modeled and that it's that the gray shouldn't actually be gray plus the yellow?
Okay, so it's a little bit tricky, right? So let me look at the dominant backgrounds. W plus jets, I have a good handle on, because I have to have missed, like the muon has to have gone through the cracks, right? But I know the distribution of muons from W plus jets. I see a lot of W plus jets. In fact, I see more W plus jets than I miss, okay? So I can convince myself that I understand the W plus jets background well enough to say that I cannot move it within what I measured, right? I can determine the W plus jets background, and it cannot move up far enough to explain whatever signal I see. Z to nu nu plus jets is a headache. Unfortunately, because GV and GA are what they are, the Z decays to neutrinos more than it does to charged leptons. So using Z2 leptons is a good technique, but you're always going to be statistically limited. Okay? So you can use Z plus jets to constrain the Z2 nu nu bar plus jets. And that's typically what you do. And then you hope, and then you say, okay, so I compare that with the Monte Carlo, and I say that the Monte Carlo, and I use the Monte Carlo to increase the statistics. And you can do that. Unfortunately, it is the tails that matter. And if your Monte Carlo gets the tails wrong, then you didn't gain. So you have to try to then work some systematic and things like that. So it's going to depend on how much more it looks like supersymmetry. Okay? But in principle, you factor when you do these background estimates for W to L nu and Z to nu nu, and if you've done them right, then this is included in your systematics and absorbed in your limit setting. Okay? And in fact, it's not a small effect, right? That's more an effect. Because the expected limit, if I remember well, is that dashed line, that greenish dashed line. Okay? And the observed limit is that reddish line. And then, in fact, but that's not really the observed limit, because there is a systematic which corresponds to that yellow band. Okay? And you see that yellow band is really pretty wide. And that's why the D0 run to excluded region is really that red, the solid red region. Okay? So in principle, you have that in your systematics. And then you can say that it's not 5 sigma. Yes?
On slide 49, you showed the output of the neuron.
Yeah.
X have a concern. You said you didn't just make it cut and counted the number of events.
Why? Oh, well, yeah. Whatever it is.
You said you used the
yes.
shape, so
why?
You make a fit. Can you elaborate?
Oh, no, you don't make a fit. You do it in bind way. You could make a fit. I think it's easier to elaborate on that using Z prime to EE. Sorry, it's easier, it's more obvious. Shapes are good when you know what you're looking for. So this is the Drellian spectrum, right? And then there's the Z here, okay? And then, let's say that I'm looking for a Z prime, which is something that looks a little bit like this. Then I have two options, right? I can say, it's all about information, really, right? I have two options. What I can do is I can cut this in little windows, right? And move mass window by mass window, and I can count the number of events I see in each mass window, and I can see whether I have a significant signal over background, right? It's the simple Poisson that Glenn was talking about. Okay. Let me do this. So here I have a little bit, there I have a little bit more, there I have a little more, and so on, right? And typically what I'm going to, there is an optimal window size, and it's like about 2 sigma times the resolution or something like that. I don't remember exactly what it is. But you can establish that to discover a signal, there is an optimum mass window size, which depends either on the width or the resolution of your detector, whichever one is larger. Right? So you can see, well, this is going to be about the optimal window because it's going to give me a large signal over background. If I go here, then, you know, here there's more background, I start losing again. Okay. But what this doesn't do is use, when I do this, I don't actually use the information that I already have in excess here. I don't use the information that I have in excess here. And because this is a couple of times my detector resolution, I don't actually use the fact that there are more events in that bin than in that bin or that bin. Okay? So if you know the shape of the signal you're looking for, you might as well say, let me check the compatibility of that curve with Trellian background plus a bright Wigner, widened with my, you know, convoluted with a Gaussian for my detector resolution, and I'll let the fit find where it prefers the central value, the peak to be. And that way, you've really used the fact that you're looking for a bright Wigner and its shape and the whole thing. And the other way, going back to this plot, it's also visible, in fact. Because I'm sure you can find, I can have a cut which I take from here to there in the Monte Carlo, right? In data, my expected signal and my expected background. And I can move that cut, and for every value of the cut, I can calculate signal over square root of background, right? Which is a simple, maybe naive, you can do something else if you want. Take some more sophisticated estimator of what your significance is going to be, right? And I can just decide a priori before looking at the data at what value I'm going to cut. And let's say that that value is here. I don't know where it is, right? But let's say that that value is here because I have all of that part of the curve, I only have that background. Okay? It's probably going to be here, but I'm going to require some minimum amount of signal, otherwise I don't see anything. So if that's here, well, okay, but I've really lost the that part of the signal. I have no information over that part. I've lost it. Don't take it into account. So by using the full shape of the distribution, I actually use all the information there is. By applying a simple cut and then counting events, you're ignoring some of the information you have. And when you're trying to do something which is really at the edge of your sensitivity, losing power is a bad thing.
It just seems like an incredibly dangerous thing to do because how do you know what kind of fit function to use?
There's no fit function. I'm doing this in a binned way. It's a histogram. Okay? I have these histograms and I have the ones with the signal and I have the ones without the signal and I can do Poisson bin by bin but using all the bins. Okay? I don't use a fit function for that. For this, I can use a fit function because I know what the function is.
Okay, so thank Gustav again.